Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Mona.
Mark, you know how we always try to do a podcast on a timely issue? Today, what we were thinking is that as there have been so many cases filed over the last 2-3 years, I-526 petitions, we are now seeing a number of RFEs. An RFE, for anyone listening, is a request for further evidence. Anybody who is at all familiar with the immigration field will know that this is a very commonplace occurrence. However, we are seeing a certain trend in some of the RFEs. We will need more than one episode to discuss RFE trends, Mark, but I thought a person who was very appropriate, not only for the Russian market, but for volume practices and for variety in RFEs, is today's guest.
That's right, Mona. Today we have attorney Arina Rostova. Arina focuses her practice on the EB-5 visa program and business visas. Her diverse business management experience allows her to extend her practical and strategic level advice to investors and entrepreneurs seeking these business visas. Arina oversees hundreds of in-process and pending EB-5 petitions. Hint, that's why we have her on talking about requests for evidence. And in fact, she represents an estimated 20 to 30% of all Russian EB-5 investors. Arina, welcome to EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on this program.
Arina, before we even jump into our topic, congratulations on being the chairperson, chairperson for the Public Policy Committee of IIUSA.
Thank you very much, Mona. It's a pleasure and a challenge to be on the committee and chairing the committee. I'm excited about the work that we're going to do this year. The goal of the committee is to identify issues that affect the industry as a whole, public policy issues, practice issues. And so once we've identified them, we come up with proposed solutions, and we try to seek those solutions either by communicating to USCIS or trying to resolve them internally, kind of through the industry, through best practices.
Well, yeah, I know the Public Policy Committee has done a lot of work. I've been a member for some years, and back in 2015, it was the Public Policy Committee who were looking at all of those draft legislations coming in and making comments, and some very important and pertinent comments. So it's an important task, and it's a lot of work, Arina. So good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mona, I know you've been involved with the Public Policy Committee, as you said, back in 2015, but I'm really not sure what quite the role is for the Public Policy Committee in EB-5 and why it's important for the industry. Arina, could you expand on that?
Yes, the role of the Public Policy Committee is to look at public policy issues on behalf of the industry as a whole. We both proactively and reactively were either suggesting solutions or future policy, but we're also commenting on proposed changes. We're also commenting on proposed legislation. Since I have been the chair of Public Policy Committee, our role is more on identifying issues that are currently affecting the industry and affecting the practice. So some of the USCIS practices that are affecting the industry as a whole. So for example, slower processing times, certain types of RFEs, our inability to see guidance on some of the new regulations that have come out. The legislative efforts have also been picked up by the board of directors of IIUSA. So the board of directors has been focused for the past 2 years on the legislative efforts, which allows the Public Policy Committee to sort of focus on getting the program to actually work the best that it can.
Yeah, I would like to add also that the team that Arina covers as well are the best of EB-5, the industry specialists. And we cover everything from economists to regional center operatives, lawyers in different areas. So we do have a lot of input from the community.
Yes, I was so highly impressed with the roster of the members of the committee because it truly is experts in every field of EB5 work. As Mona mentioned, you know, we have representatives from the regional centers, economists, attorneys, we have bankers. So it really allows to combine information and in real time assess the situation and the issues that are most pertinent to the industry, to the development of the industry, and to the success of this program.
Right. So again, it's another one of our EB5 voices, Mark. But Irina, you deal a lot with the Russian markets. You're one of the very few people that we reach out to who has such an expertise in that market. What are you seeing? And not just the Russian market, of course, you deal with other markets too. But right now, this is the start of 2020. We have the increased amount of investment. There is this little uncertainty in the field. What are you seeing? Are you seeing investors come looking for EB5?
Well, I am happy to report that overall, the EB5 program seems to be doing quite well despite the recent changes in the Russian market. As a matter of fact, until recently, it was still largely unknown to most of the markets. And the Russian market encompasses the country of Russia and the former Soviet republics, where most of the population speaks the Russian language.
Like the Central Asian countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan, etc.
Absolutely. The countries that you mentioned are still one of the fewest to, they're still very new to EB5. And it's a great example of how unknown the program was in those regions. We're seeing more movement from Kazakhstan, Ukraine, the Baltic states. But the market as a whole is doing surprisingly well in terms of interest in the program. There's been some changes in the economy in that entire region in the last few years, where we used to see that most Russian investors preferred European investment migration programs. So that when they were thinking about relocating their families or relocating their assets, they were looking at the European or the Caribbean migration programs for various reasons.
Like Cyprus.
Correct.
Cyprus has totally gone and changed. It feels like a Russian extension now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We definitely have a few hubs outside of Russia that Russia has claimed. I mean, Israel, Cyprus, among those. Spain at one point also started to get a pretty significant influx of Russian investors, and of course, central London. But in the last few years, we're seeing less and less interest in the European programs, partly because of the uncertainty of the Brexit and the economic uncertainty of what's going to happen in the European Union, and partly because some of the investors that have educated their kids in the European universities, they do see that the United States just offers tremendous opportunities in industries like tech and finance. And so more people have started considering the US. And as a result, we're seeing heightened interest in the EB5 program from the Russian investors.
But you don't just deal with Russia, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm very lucky. I think that I have one of those practices where I think I've seen an investor from pretty much every country that has ever filed an EB5 visa. We're especially big in the Russian market and the Taiwanese market, but we work with Latin America, we work with Europe, African countries. Overall, I have to say that the processing times, I think, have affected the industry, and it yeah. is a deterrent. Despite that, I think countries that don't have alternative solutions, for example, Russia and Brazil, where there's no E2 treaty, those countries, the demand for EB5 continues because they don't have an alternative, a cheaper alternative to move into the United States. So they're willing to move forward with the higher investment amount and the longer processing times.
Right. We're seeing more non-immigrant visas coming from these two countries also, as people do file petitions, but they need a non-immigrant visa to enter the country.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. We're definitely seeing that we have to come up with additional solutions. If the processing time is 3 years, then some of these families want to come a little bit earlier and start studying English. Some of them are coming in on some business visas to open affiliate companies here. So we definitely need to think of additional solutions for them during the wait time for EB5.
Right. So, Irina, we wanted to discuss all the RFE trends with you. We know that we're going to have several podcasts to discuss. There are so many things happening, but you are seeing what we are seeing, a considerable amount of increase of RFEs, and many of them quite unreasonable. It feels like USCIS doesn't even understand what burden of proof really means.
I think we agree that, unfortunately, USCIS does not understand what the burden of proof is. And it seems like they also have a very different idea of what they believe their role is in this program. They seem to be taking on tasks that they were neither trained for, nor do they have the budget for. And they're trying to do due diligence, which their staff was not trained on. And therefore, it just slows down the process. And instead of creating a good outcome, it slows down the industry and creates, I think, a worse outcome and some problems that we're seeing where projects are delayed and investors are delayed.
Totally agree with that, Irina, that so far what we are seeing, for example, is that USCIS, perhaps one example is they're looking at a dynamic industry and putting the kind of questions and the kind of response that you would in perhaps a constructive project, construction project rather than a dynamic project. And they just are not capable. In fact, it's become a totalitarian regime if you look at what they're actually trying to do.
I agree. And even if their intention is not, even if their intentions are good and they're trying to eliminate, as they have said, bad players from the program, unfortunately, their approach is just incorrect. What we're seeing, and I think one of the biggest trends that we're seeing, is an overall presumption of guilt. We're seeing a presumption of guilt on the investor side and the project side. And then they're asking the project or the investor to overcome a presumption of guilt. Obviously, it's very unreasonable. It's very unfair, but it also doesn't achieve the goal that they're trying to achieve. It doesn't actually reduce fraud at all. By creating longer processing times, they're actually allowing bad actors to stay in the game much longer.
We've also seen, Irina, that they're adjudicating 526 petitions as if they were I-829 petitions. And for the listener, that means I-829 petitions have different issues as you're looking at a business 3 years later when you have to adjudicate job creation and a flow of money. And these are not necessarily the issues that you need to adjudicate at the 526 level.
Absolutely. We agree with that completely. We do see that they're starting to apply standards for I-829 petition to I-526 petitions, and we have argued that previously. Another trend that we're seeing is we're questioning on the project side. One of the RFE trends is they're talking a lot about material change.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we have been advocating for is differentiating between what is material for EB5 purposes versus what is generally a material change in a project. Because for EB5 purposes, we have to create jobs and we have to use a reasonable means to achieve that. So if we're changing the color of the building or if we're changing the structure of the building a little bit, it is not material for EB5 purposes because the job creation is not affected.
However, though, there is a material change if they're changing the location of that building halfway through, which we are starting to see that, say, a business is not doing so well, so they relocate that building prior to all of the cases being adjudicated. That is a material change.
It's interesting that you bring it up because I have cases where we have argued in the original business plan, we have shown that the location is a selected location or something within that proximity within a few miles. Because for various reasons, the location may not be final as the project continues. And in my opinion, if the project itself doesn't change, for example, if we're building a hospital, it doesn't really make a difference if the final location is a mile or two away from the original location, as long as it services the same population.
Well, I would disagree with you here, Ian. I would disagree. I'll tell you why. It's not just the job creation that you look at as far as material change. I really don't want to go into depth on this, but it's also the very fact that a mile away or even around the corner could make a difference as far as Profitability. As far as profitability is concerned, let me take, for example, a franchise. A food franchise on one corner could make a lot of money. Two blocks away, it just might be in a bad location. So the viability of that project could make a difference between investors coming into that project or not. So I would say that, yes, I would disagree with you. I would say that there was a change.
I think that the location can be material, but we have to look at the project. And I agree with you on the franchise or retail aspect or even a hotel aspect, where a two block difference can make a complete difference in terms of the project's viability and profitability. But there are certain businesses that are, when they were planned, as long as they're located on a certain street, a mile one way, a mile east, a mile west, does not actually make a difference in terms of its profitability. For example, schools is a great example. Schools are servicing a certain district, so their location can be within a few miles from the original location. They will still service the same students because they're servicing students within a certain radius.
Well, unless under the new regulations, the USCIS new regulations, that the TEA census tracts change. And that can happen. We have one census tract, one end is a TEA and one end is not. So that's another important issue to look at.
I think the general consensus is we have to look at what is material for that business and what is material for the EB-5 purpose of that business.
Sure.
And that's different from every application.
Right. So other project RFEs, as we're now jumping onto project RFEs, Arena, what other than material change, what do you see with regards to the project, not to the investor?
I have a fun one that that we'll see that trend a lot. I think it happened because of the JPEG fraud incident or mixing of the funds in various JPEG projects. We are seeing RFEs where USCIS is asking to show how, when we have, for example, one NCE that is providing capital to different JCEs, they're asking to show how those funds are traced and whether or not each investor actually knows which project they're investing into. Mm. So we're seeing that trend. So for a lot of projects where they had a fund system, where it was one NCE and then that NCE would fund different projects, or
that should be apparent in the PPM, no?
But that's also in the escrow agreement, and there's escrow agents that are dealing with that, and that just seems so obvious. I think the issue is the escrow agents in JPEG were actually involved. So the bank that was supposed to serve as the escrow agent, they were involved in the fraud and they were not following the escrow agreement. And that's where USCIS is probably getting this concern from. But at the end of the day, if you have instructions and your escrow agent, such as a giant bank, is not following them, that's really not the investor's fault.
Right. We're also seeing a trend, I don't know if you are, about the USCIS questioning funds within the NCE. If, for example, the developers have put funds into the NCE, so they want to know the source of everything. Previously, they didn't used to ask this point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have seen that too, where they will ask for a source of funds for co-investors, which technically under the regulations, they may ask, but it just seems quite unreasonable when you have co-investors that are not seeking the green card and that are not subject to the standard, you know, and we've never had standards. Under which standards are we supposed to provide the documents? But we are seeing that trend, I agree.
Right. So with regards to the investor, what are you seeing as to RFE trends?
Well, one of the biggest ones is we're seeing requests to show accumulation of funds and savings in bank accounts. I think that this is an important trend to discuss because, A, I legally disagree with the correctness of asking for that, because in most countries, investors do not accumulate all their savings in bank accounts, simply because banks are not as stable as they are in the United States. So for many, it's very common to earn their funds lawfully, receive the funds through bank accounts, and then withdraw the funds and actually keep them in cash in safe deposit boxes or at safes at home.
Is that more with your Russian clients, your Taiwanese clients?
Definitely more with Russian. The Taiwanese have a pretty stable banking system, but we absolutely see it in Russia, the former Soviet Union. We see it in Vietnam. We see it across African countries and some Middle Eastern countries.
Right, wherever there really isn't a secure banking system. Are you seeing RFE trends relating to businesses showing actual doing business and not being shell companies?
Yes, that is another trend that we're seeing is more. So providing personal and business tax returns is no longer sufficient. USCIS wants proof.
Wow.
Oh, and they will state providing tax returns is not the sufficient proof of lawful income. I've seen that text in a few RFEs. So they're asking to show actual real live activity, whether it's because they're worried that these funds were put and deposited into banks and declared on tax returns just to cleanse them, or because they are really trying to understand what type of investors are going into these projects. But they're asking to show invoices, contracts with clients, and they're just generally asking for more evidence of a real and operating business that provides a real service.
That's so interesting, especially relating to tax issues with a shell company. Let's see how that moves forward, because obviously here in the United States, if you have a pass-through company, you have a tax advantage. And I'm presuming that that issue is overseas as well.
Yes, we're seeing a lot of requests for companies in Hong Kong. For example, it's very common for Russian entrepreneurs to have companies in Hong Kong. So they're engaged in trade. They open a company in Hong Kong because they're not subject to local business taxation, because their company is not performing activities on the territory of Hong Kong. There's no business tax. So they can have a pass-through entity where they can engage in import-export activity. So they're importing things from China into Russia. They're not paying tax on the business side. And then the income just passes through as personal income to the Russian owner, and then they just pay the personal tax. And we're seeing definitely a lot of requests on those companies as well as companies in Dubai.
Yeah, the Dubai company. But the thing is, in Dubai, there is a lot of due diligence which occurs before you can set up a company. I'm not sure so much that they're still doing the same in Hong Kong, but I do know for sure that Dubai, it's not so straightforward. Arina, third-party transfers. Now, because we deal with a lot of Chinese cases previously, we've had a lot of issues with third-party transfers. Are you seeing this issue come up?
Yes. I think that trend started pretty early. We've seen it for the past probably year and a half.
Right.
Third-party transfers are definitely questioned. USCIS wants to see licenses for any company that was used in third-party transfers. And we've had situations where investors have transferred funds through another business or entity, and we had to provide a lot of evidence that this business was a legitimate business and it was a legitimate transaction, and they returned the funds or paid them for the services in the US.
Right. We're seeing more denials, actually, with regards to Chinese cases, which is totally opposite from what we, you know, the trend was a few years back.
I think our office specifically has been somewhat lucky on that. We have definitely seen RFEs, but we have been able to provide licenses for the services that our clients have used. But I do know that in the industry, we're seeing an upswing of denials and cases we
That's
have
right.
previously had approved.
I think, Karina, when you're talking about third-party transfers, what does make a difference is that you deal more with Taiwanese as opposed to mainland China. And with mainland China, the problem that we're seeing that USCIS is picking up on the fact that a same entity or same person or same individual is acting as the third-party transfer. And unfortunately, that's also happening in cases from places like Iran as well.
We have seen that it was more of an issue for our Middle Eastern clients, I think, than even for our Asian clients.
Arina, I know this really isn't an RFE trend, but this is such a huge issue which is happening right now. And I also want to know if you're doing anything with regards to this issue with public policy. What's happening on the administrative processing side? Because we are seeing a huge increase on that front.
Absolutely. I think we have seen an upswing in administrative processing. We have seen a general change in the last 2 years, and in the last few months, it seems like that has become a standard procedure. I think certain countries are affected the most. Russia, some of the Middle Eastern countries are definitely affected more.
Yeah.
But it appears that consular officers are under so much pressure from, you know, this extreme vetting initiative that they simply cannot make a decision. The interviews have gone from being a formality and 10 minutes long. We are now seeing the immigrant visa interview for EB-5 cases takes an hour to an hour and a half, where investors are being asked questions that are really irrelevant to their petition.
Right.
And they're being asked about their relatives, if any of their relatives have been in politics. They're asking about their former businesses. And it appears that as long as the consular officer finds any business connection to any possible lawsuit or a negative article, they put the case in administrative processing. Obviously, this is a big issue. And thank you, Mona, for bringing it up. I do think that this is something we plan to discuss during our next call for public policy and see if as an industry, we can start getting ahead of this issue, because that's just lack of training and lack of procedure. If negative articles were a reason to deny entry for any investor into the United States, I mean, yeah. President Trump would not be our president.
Well, I feel like we've really explored, yet are just covering the surface of some of these requests for evidence trends that we're seeing. We've talked about the source of funds and some of the issues there, as well as third-party transfer concerns, as well as when RFEs may go a little too far with administrative processing, and at sometimes it may feel like it's getting personal, looking into other relatives. So for that, I'm glad, Arena, that we had you on EB-5 Investment Voice, and I really appreciate the work that you are doing and will be continuing to do as the new chairperson for the Public Policy Committee. Thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have this discussion with you.
Thanks, Arena.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.